you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
Hello and welcome to Empire with me, Anita Arnand.
And me, William Durrettpool. And today we've got something a little bit different.
October 1973, the Yom Kippur War, the day Arabs crossed the Suez Canal into the Sinai. The intelligence failure that made this possible, the extraordinary military engineering that made this happen, and the oil embargo that made the whole world feel the consequences. This is by absolutely any measure one of the great thrillers, if you like, of the 20th century.
I think we should start with one of Avi Schleim's great insights from his book, The Iron Wall. And he very much blames the intelligence failures in 1973, the fact that the Egyptians were able to surprise the Israelis as much as they did, to what he calls ha concepcia in Hebrew. It's a set of assumptions that he says are deeply embedded in the Israeli military thinking of the period. And it allows the Israelis completely to underestimate all the Arab armies, but particularly the Egyptians.
Can you talk us through the assumptions and just make those clear to us?
So if you remember back in the 1967 episode that we did with Eugene, the key Israeli coup was to destroy the Egyptian Air Force, the enormous Egyptian Air Force at that point, on the ground in the first 10 minutes of the war. And an idea embedded itself in Israeli military thinking that Egypt will not go to war without first achieving air superiority over Israel. And as they'd lost most of their air force in 1967 and had yet to rebuild it, that basically Israel was completely safe. The other idea is that Syria, which was a smaller power than Egypt. Egypt, we don't really think of today as a kind of major military power in the Middle East, but it was in the 1960s. And the idea that Israel had at this point was that Syria would not attack without Egypt, and that a coordinated Egyptian-Syrian assault was therefore impossible if there hadn't been a proper Egyptian rebuilding of its air wing. It's a very reasonable assumption. Air power is the key in desert warfare. And Egypt genuinely had not restored its air force to anything like 1967 levels. But according to Avi's assessment, this had led to such contempt for the Arab armies following this lightning victory in 1967 that we talked about, that they simply thought there was really no possibility of Arab assault on Israel in the early 70s, and therefore there were no countermeasures in place.
Israel thought nobody will act without Egypt say so, and Nasser is not there to say so anymore. That's also not a ridiculous assumption, and the man who comes to replace him, Anwar Sadat, they underestimate him. So let me tell you a little bit about Anwar Sadat. He's born in 1918 in a small village in the Nile Delta. He's dark-skinned. And this is important because it is still a society where, you know, the lighter-skinned people are the ones with the power, and being dark-skinned carried a social stigma. So he's regarded, really, in Cairo politics as a provincial outsider, sort of a yokel.
He's called the donkey, in fact, initially, by the kind of the grandees in Cairo, yeah.
But when he inherits the presidency from Nasser in 1970, he's had years in prison. He's had years in opposition to think about, you know, what he would do if he was in charge of Egypt, what Egypt needs to maintain that position that it did have under Nasser, being the colossus of the Middle East. And what he decides is the most daring strategic analysis of any Arab leader of his generation, that Egypt cannot afford to remain at war with Israel. I mean, it's a striking thing. People haven't dared to say it or even think it. The economy is wrecked. His army, humiliated twice in a decade. The Air Force destroyed. Sinai, gone. And now you've got the Soviets, who are there thick on the ground, dragging their feet about sending their most sophisticated weapons to Egypt. So he realizes that if he's going to get any of this back, restore the honor, you know, do something about this humiliation, he needs to get Sinai back, and he can't get Sinai back without America. So getting America requires sort of demonstrating to Washington that there is a status quo in the Middle East.
So no one really wants to sort of break the deadlock. Israel has got hold of the West Bank and Gaza. Jordan has lost the West Bank. Egypt has lost Gaza. The Soviets, who were very enthusiastic backers of Egypt, have now got a bit cold on him, and they're just not sending the new weapons. Particularly, they want anti-aircraft missiles, the SAM missile systems, and they're not getting them. And they can tell that the Soviets are sort of going a bit cold on them. So the whole thing is stuck. And he also has this long-term idea of basically dumping the Soviets and going over to under the American umbrella. You can see that America is the growing economy of the moment, and he thinks it's a better bet. So he's got that he has to somehow re-engage everybody in the Middle East. And he has this idea that if he can make at least a decent stab at getting the Sinai back, he can put the whole business of occupied territory back on the agenda. So he comes up with this idea with great patience and precision, and it's a bit of a genius plan. He first of all mobilizes the Egyptian army in May 1973, and Israel mobilizes its reserves thinking that war is coming, and then he stands them down. In August, the same thing happens again. So he sort of trains the Israelis not to take these Egyptian mobilizations seriously. In other words, he's sort of calling wolf.
It hits them in the exchequer, because every time they mobilize, it's not cheap, you know, tens of millions of dollars.
And the idea is that he's sort of training them to ignore him. And Mossad buys this. They come to the conclusion that they don't need to take what they regard as Egyptian theater seriously.
But it's a brilliant deception. If a deception is going to work, you do the same thing again and again. People expect the same result again and again. But then in the week before October the 6th, the Egyptian army stages what looks like to the Israelis, oh, they're off again, you know, another exercise, massive troop concentrations visible from Israeli observation posts on the Eastern Bank, Israeli intelligence assessing, you know, oh, well, this is the same as we saw, you know, last Tuesday. The exercise is scheduled to conclude on October the 7th. The Israelis note the dates, they file the reports, but they don't mobilize this time. Remember, you know, sort of tens of millions every time you mobilize, because the idea is, you know, this is just mere theater. If not mobilizing, how is Israel fortified? I mean, do they have defensive positions if they're not moving into attacking positions?
So at the end of 1967, the border resolves itself at the Suez Canal. And at the far side of the Suez Canal, the Israelis have built something called the Bar-Lev Line, which has cost millions to put in place. It's regarded as absolutely state of the art. It's on the eastern bank of the Suez Canal and consists of 33 heavily fortified strong points built into and atop of a sand rampart, which is a massive 20 to 25 meters high. That's roughly eight stories, running 150 kilometers along the entire length of the canal bank. So the Israelis think that they're, you know, completely secure. They've got bunkers, observation posts, tank ramps, connecting roads, allowing reinforcements within hours. It's like a sort of modern version of Hadrian's Wall, if you like. And the idea is that this is impregnable, and Israeli military engineers have estimated it would take any Egyptian crossing force at least 24 to 48 hours to breach that rampart, to establish bridges. And during that time, again, thanks to the conception, the idea is that the Israeli Air Force, which has shown itself to be so incredibly brilliant in 1967, will simply destroy any Arab Air Force or any Arab ground forces that get across the canal. They'd be shredded. In Israeli eyes, the Bar-Lev Line isn't just a fortification, it's a guarantee of time, and it gives the Israelis the times to mobilize the reserve and get these aircraft shot down.
Secure in the knowledge that the Soviets have not given surface-to-air missiles.
They have given a few, but haven't given as many as the Egyptians want, yeah.
So, okay, so I mean, that does sound like it's a good plan on the Israeli side. What's going on in Sadat's mind?
So Sadat has had the advantage of a young Egyptian military engineering genius called Baki Zaki Yusuf. And Baki Zaki Yusuf is sitting at his desk looking at plans of the Bar-Lev sand rampart. And he has an idea so simple, it's almost absurd. It's made of packed sand, this line. You don't blow up sand, you wash it away. And he proposes to use high-pressure water cannons. And they've already got these high-pressure equipment at the canal because it's used for dredging operations in the canal. So they have everything they need already to hand. And he has this genius idea that he will attach these pumps to floats. He'll float the pumps in the canal and he'll wash away the sandbank with powerful jets of water and do it instantly. So they test this. And to everyone's thrill on the Egyptian side, when they try it out, it works perfectly. So they quietly import 300 more British-made petrol-driven pumps, 150 more German pumps are added to it with gas turbines. And each combination of two German pumps or three British pumps can, they estimate, blast through a 15-meter section of wall in under 2 hours.
Wow.
And so this fortification that's built to withstand an artillery onslaught could be washed away with jets of water very quickly.
The timing is important because in the Israeli reckoning, 48 hours it buys them to get the Air Force up in the air to strafe and deal with whatever's coming behind. But actually in 2 hours, that's just completely game-changing.
Exactly that. So they have one other very clever idea, which is to do this on the holiest day of the Jewish year.
The day where observant Israelis, they fast, they go to synagogue, roads are empty. This is a huge practical obstacle because you choose a date like that, you're choosing a date when the army simply has not got its boots on.
Yeah, literally. Yeah.
So take us to 2:05 in the afternoon, because that time is very notable.
So they pick on this time, 2:05 p.m. And at this point, 2,000 guns, rocket launchers and mortars open up simultaneously. And the noise is so massive it's heard in Cairo, but some 200 miles away. 2,000 artillery pieces firing 10,500 shells in the first minute, 175 shells per second. And the Israeli strong points on the eastern bank, each manned by a small platoon of reservists, are immediately overwhelmed. Simultaneously, 250 Egyptian military aircraft take off and strike the Israeli air bases, radar installations, command centers, and artillery positions in the Sinai. Exactly what the Israelis had done to them in 67, the Egyptians succeed in doing. Only into the Sinai, but still. And then, in an operation which somehow Mossad, the legendary Israeli intelligence service, has somehow not got their eyes on, they have rehearsed this operation hundreds of times. 8,000 Egyptian infantry in 1,000 rubber assault boats cross the Suez Canal in the first wave. They paddle across under fire, land on the eastern bank, and immediately begin clearing paths through the minefields beyond the sand rampart. Behind them, within minutes, the water cannons
tear into the packed sand, enormous pressure aimed at them. Within 4.5 hours, just 4.5 hours, the Egyptians managed to blast 80 separate breaches in the Barlev sand rampart. 80 gaps, 80 spaces wide enough to carry vehicles and bridges and armor, 3 million cubic meters of packed sand. And think of it as the beach analogy. Of, you know, sort of these enormous structures which just crumble with the blast of water.
Through these gaps, 10 heavy pontoon bridges and 5 light bridges, pre-packed, pre-rehearsed, snapped into place by Egyptian engineering units under fire. And by midnight on October the 6th, just 10 hours after the attack began, 10 bridges are in place across the canal. 50 ferries are operating, 80,000 Egyptian troops are on the eastern bank. By the morning of October 7th, the crossing is more or less complete. 100,000 troops, 900 tanks, and 12,000 support vehicles have crossed the Suez Canal. All but one of the Barlev fortifications have been captured or destroyed. And most importantly, these Soviet SAM missiles, which the Egyptians are so keen to get their hands on, the ones they have got, have brought down 27 Israeli planes in the opening hours of the war.
Join us after the break, where we take you through the next few hours of what everybody thought was impossible.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. One of the lessons of history is that uncertain times are nothing new. Kingdoms falter, governments lose their nerves, and ordinary people find themselves living through times and events that they didn't choose. What's new is the closeness of it, the way that the anxieties of an age now arrive without a pause. Staying informed matters, but so does the ability to keep one's footing in these uncertain times. BetterHelp connects you with qualified therapists here in the UK, matching your needs and preferences with the option to change if the fit is not right. It's a way of creating a little distance from the noise and thinking more clearly about how you are responding to it. Therapy can offer perspective, space, to talk things through, to understand emotions, and to keep each new development in proportion, rather than let it crowd everything out. BetterHelp makes starting therapy easy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/empire. That's betterhelp.com/empire.
Hey, this is Michael and Hannah from Goal Hangers, The Rest is Science.
This episode is brought to you by Cancer Research UK.
We often think of beating cancer as treatment, but imagine stopping it before it begins. After years of work, Cancer Research UK scientists are launching a clinical trial of LungVax, the first vaccine designed to prevent lung cancer.
It builds on TRACERx, the world's largest cancer evolution study, which tracked lung cancer cells over many years to uncover the disease's earliest warning signs. LungVax is designed to train the immune system to spot these signs early on, destroying faulty cells before cancer develops.
So it's not treatment, but preventative, with the potential to stop lung cancer before it starts. The first stage of the trial starts this year, focusing on people at higher risk.
It shows what long-term research makes possible.
For more information about Cancer Research UK, their research, breakthroughs, and how you can support them, visit cancerresearchuk.org/the rest is science.
Welcome back. This must have been like a catastrophic, unimaginable bolt from the blue.
It really was. And just as the Egyptians were gobsmacked by the Israeli preemptive strike in 1967, which wipes out all their aircraft, so the Israelis now have, it's their turn to feel both terrified and amazed. As they hear this crossing has been made, that this brilliant military operation has taken place, that all these bridges are in place and the tanks have crossed. And it isn't just in the north, because at exactly the moment that the mortars open fire at the Suez Canal, the Syrians have gone into action to attack the Golan Heights.
When you say it's coordinated, you're saying Egypt and Syria knew exactly minute by minute what was going to happen. This is all pre-agreed. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Those of you who have not heard our bonus with Avi Syme, we should say that the great revelation he has is that King Hussein had dropped heavy hints
to Golda Meir
that Egypt and Syria were up to something and that Israel should be on guard. But she went off to a conference the next day and somehow nothing happened. And this was, I think, just 4 days before the assault. So nothing happens because it's the day before the big holiday.
Also because, you know, they've gone through the Six-Day War, really. You know, yeah. They know what it is and they're not bothered. You know, what's the worst they can do? And then suddenly you've got this pincer movement. What is the Israeli response to that?
So the initial Egyptian assault is a complete success. They move right into Sinai. They down the aircraft that are meant to be attacking them. And it's, 100% success. The Syrian assault onto the Golan Heights, being this mountainous eminence, which was grabbed by Israel in 1967. And now the Syrians are trying to get back. They have to attack uphill and it's much more hard work. It's not just crossing over a bridge into a desert. It is a massive tank assault uphill at the Golan Heights. And the Israelis are completely outnumbered. There is only 177 Israeli tanks in place that morning as 1,400 Syrian tanks come at them. It's a ratio of 8-1. But the geography is on Israel's side. And there is an extraordinary resistance by the tank regiments at the Golan Heights. And Israel loses more than 150 tanks on the Golan Heights in the first 2 days alone, but it does not lose the heights. Much of the heights remain in Israeli hands.
I'm really intrigued, though, but what people like Moshe Dayan, who we've spoken about before, you know, he of the iconic eye patch, the defense minister, hero of 1967, you know, a man who was held up as, look, we can withstand a 6 day war and be victorious. He gets in touch with Golda Meir. She was the Iron Lady of Israel, one of its founding leaders. Born in Kyiv in 1898, grew up in a family of poverty and persecution, the pogroms of the Russian Empire. She migrated into Wisconsin, joined the Labour Zionist Party in the United States, and soon after marrying her husband, when she was just 19, they moved back to Mandate Palestine in 1921. And straight away, she's involved in politics. She's very active in trade unions, in the Jewish Agency, becoming one of the signatories of Israel's Declaration of Independence in 1948. And then she rises to the position of foreign minister from 1956 to 1966. And it's after the death of Prime Minister Levi Eshkol in 1969, where, you know, you have a short period where you've got Yigal Allon, famously of the Allon plan, who served as interim prime minister. There's a snap election. And then in March 1969, the Labour Party invites Golda Meir out of retirement, because bear in mind, she's 70 now, to run as prime minister. So she becomes Israel's first and so far only female prime minister. Anyways, so that's who we're talking about. What do we know about their response to this and the conversations that they're having? I mean, there must have been frantic phone calls going on here.
So again, it's Avi Schleim who's found the smoking gun, and he has evidence in the Iron Wall that nuclear options are discussed because Israel has the bomb at this point. They think they're going to lose Jerusalem. Some of the tanks are heading down towards the Lake of Tiberias, and this could be the end. Israel is saved by the fact that the 7th Armored Brigade, led by somebody called Colonel Avigdor Kahalani, he holds his position in the northern Golan, in what will be known as the Valley of Tears. And he fights for 4 days, almost without sleep or resupply, drawing on incredible reserves of strength to destroy literally hundreds of Soviet battle tanks coming down from the Syrian side of the border in one of the most remarkable feats of war. And this basically saves Israel, because again, if the Syrians had broken through over the Golan and completely destroyed the Israeli positions, it would have been game over. And this allows time for the United States to step in and resupply.
So the United States, yes, our involvement in this is interesting because, you know, seeing this unimpeded attack from two different sides, the US decides to airlift an entire new tank regiment into Israel. So resupplies the army. This is, remember, the Nixon administration. And they are in a difficult position because they want to make inroads into the Arab world.
Arab oil is already important at this point.
Does sound familiar to anybody?
So they do not want to fall out with the Arab world. And yet
they can't let Israel go because Israel is an absolute ally, a predictable ally in this region.
And there's also, I think, the sense that the Syrians and the Egyptians are Russian supplied.
Not without merit, because remember, both of these places have been thick with Soviets in very high positions. You know, Sadat will eventually take a broom and clean them out of Egypt. But, you know, they're right. You know, there are Soviets in departments of labor, armaments, working, you know, at every single level. And by the way, Soviets who are working with utter disdain for the Egyptians they're working with.
Which Sadat picks up and resents.
Yeah. And he hates it. You know, it's humiliating to have these Russian speakers who are treating the people of their own country like second-class citizens. So just in this equation, you know, what they're seeing is, okay, the Arabs have got Soviet weapons, so we'll give the Israelis American weapons. And, you know, there's an emergency request to restore the depleted arsenal from Israel. And President Nixon approves legislation on October the 18th for a $2.2 billion arms package for the Jewish state.
And just to put this in context, if you remember back to our 1967 Six-Day War episode, the main arms supplier for the Israelis at that point had been not America, but the French. The aircraft were Mirages. Dassault was the main aircraft supplier. This is the point at which the US, for the first time, puts everything behind Israel. It's no surprise today, because we're used to Israel, you know, getting massive arm infusions from America. It's been happening, you know, over the last 2 years with Gaza, week after week. But this is something new in 1973. Not completely new, because there are American weapons already, but the scale of the American package.
Well, 2.2 billion. I mean, there's never been anything like that. I mean, that's
exactly
a crazy amount. Willie, I mean, it's where America most visibly enters the fray. It's also a time when Ariel Sharon enters the fray as a truly dominant figure. Can you talk us through, first of all, who is he?
So we've met him once before on Empire during the Suez episodes with Alex von Tunzelmann. And anyone that hasn't heard those, Alex is fantastic. Go back and listen to those. Sharon made his name doing operations over enemy lines. He'd go into Jordan and in response to Fedayeen attacks over the border. One way, he would go and destroy Arab villages. And he was very ruthless. He was renowned from the beginning as being someone that would just take out civilians without any compunction. By 1973, he is a veteran. He's 55 years old. And he's beginning to be a bit heavier than he was as this young commando who made his name attacking into Gaza and attacking into Jordan in the 60s and 50s. He's broad-shouldered, heavy, and he's been fighting Arabs and sometimes his own military superiors for his entire adult life.
They sort of find him what? Insubordinate? That, you know, they'll issue orders and he'll go off and do what he wants.
Correct.
Is that why he has a problem with top brass?
But he wins battles. And he is greatly loved by his men. And he is the kind of superstar of the Israeli special forces. And he's renowned for his reprisal operations that even senior Israeli figures regard as disproportionate. So he's already fought in 48, 56, Suez, 67. He's brilliant, fearless, insubordinate, utterly ruthless. And the Israeli military establishment both kind of loves and fears him in equal measures. But he is the hero of the hour, because having now stopped the Syrian advance over the Golan Heights, it's time for the counterattack against the Egyptians into Sinai. It is Sharon who, on October the 14th, realizes that the Egyptians have made a mistake. October the 14th, Sadat, under pressure to relieve the battered Syrians, who are now the focus of Israeli defense operations, orders his armored divisions to advance out beyond their bridgehead into the open Sinai. And this means that they have to move beyond this famous SAM missile umbrella.
The surface-to-air missiles. I keep reminding people, because you boys love your acronyms.
I grew up with SAM missiles. Anyway, in the open desert, the Egyptian tanks, which are, you know, in their great numbers, have crossed over, but have not advanced very far. They now advance.
Well, they're sort of open completely in an open desert. The Sinai is just an open desert.
It is. I mean, in a sense, it's good tag territory. In that, it's for most of it, it's fairly flat. There are mountains, but you can drive around them. But they are open to Israeli air attack. And on a single afternoon on October the 14th, the Egyptians lose, we don't know the exact numbers, but between 150 and 250 tanks are destroyed by the Israeli Air Force. It's the largest tank battle since Kursk in 1943. You have to go right back to the Second World War to find something like this. And this is Sharon's moment. He is commanding the 143rd Reserve Armored Division, and he finds a gap between the Egyptian 2nd and 3rd Armies near the Great Bitter Lake. And he wants to cross the canal into Egypt itself. The idea is that if you can cut through, you can isolate the Egyptians in the Sinai, cut them off. And this plan, it is audacious to the point of recklessness. He reaches the crossing point. The Israeli forces have to fight through a place called Chinese Farm, which is a kind of Japanese-built agricultural station in the Sinai, held by Egyptian commandos. And the battle for the Chinese Farm is one of the bloodiest of the entire war. The Israeli paratroopers fight through the night in narrow irrigation channels, close quarters combats, and the casualties are terrible. But there is a breakthrough. In the early hours of October the 16th, Israeli forces are now west of the Suez Canal, behind the entire Egyptian army.
So, I mean, what it does mean is that Sharon's men are able to cross into Egypt, west of the Suez, behind the Egyptian army. The bridgehead expands. Forces are able to drive north towards Ismailia, heading towards Suez. I mean, always the hot point of every conflict in this region. And they cut the supply lines of the Egyptian Third Army. I mean, that's devastating. You're in a desert.
You need your supplies.
You don't have a supply line. You die. There is literally nothing to be found.
And they've advanced by October the 22nd to within 100 kilometers of Cairo. So this is an extraordinary military achievement by the Israeli tag regiments.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Israel has turned what seemed like a near catastrophe into something that certainly looks like a military victory.
So this is where, in a sense, Sadat's genius is located, because he has realized, and his aim is not complete victory. He never thought that he could invade Israel, destroy the state of Israel. That was never part of the plan.
This is the shaking the cage thing you were talking about, which is notice us, take us seriously. That's what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay.
And what it does is it opens him up to be in negotiations now. It makes the Soviets take them seriously. It makes the Americans take them seriously.
Get them a seat at the table, William.
Exactly. And so in February 1973, Sadat makes a direct peace proposal. And what we'll hear in the next episode is the whole story of Camp David and this extraordinary voyage of Sadat to Israel. That is going to be our next episode with the wonderful Eugene Rogan.
It is an amazing story. People in khakis and slacks deciding the fate of the world. If you don't want to wait for that episode, why would you? Join our club, empirepoduk.com, empirepoduk.com, and you'll get it straight after you've heard this. Willie, I wanted to ask you a question. Sadat has won a seat at the table, but at what cost? Can you talk us through numbers? I mean, how many are killed?
So 2,688 Israeli soldiers die in October 1973 as a direct result of this assault. And the Arab numbers are less clear, much higher, about 8,000 Arab dead. Avi Shaim has written wonderfully on this. He makes the point that, you know, had the Israelis not been lured into complacency, all this could have been avoided. That there were warnings from King Hussein. There were clear signs that the Egyptians were planning something, and the Israelis didn't take it seriously. Despite a military defeat for Egypt, this succeeds in shaking the cage, getting the Egyptians back on the table, putting the momentum into the search for a Middle Eastern peace.
So is this a tale of two stories? Both sides, Egypt and Israel, claiming victory. Is that where we are?
And when you go to Egypt today, this is regarded as the great Egyptian victory. It's by the fact that Ariel Sharon surrounded the army and cut them off and all that, it is remembered as a victory, despite the reality of ultimate military defeat. But the peace is much more complicated, as Sadat had calculated. And Golda Meir is forced to resign in April 1974. Moshe Dayan's career is over because he hadn't prepared for it. Labour Zionism, the movement that founded Israel, the Labour Party in charge for the whole of the period up to now, never recovers. And the October earthquake, as it's sometimes called, has shattered the political status quo.
So sort of these founding fathers and mothers, if you like, are sort of, you know, not trusted because, you know, how did you not see this coming? There'll be a commission that looks into the failure of intelligence in the run-up to this. And the nation, you know, again, facing what it thinks is an existential threat to state, then turns to Likud, the right-wing conservative party under Menachem Begin, are in power. They're the ones who are trusted, and there are consequences. I just want to go back to the question of, you know, America's involvement and oil, because 1973 doesn't just transform what Israel thinks of its own security, getting Egypt back in the spotlight. It transforms the global economy too. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah. So this, again, is something that Sadat had anticipated and planned for. Before all this, at the same sort of time as he is buying in pumps from Germany and planning all this, he pays a visit to King Faisal in Saudi Arabia, and he tells him about his secret war plans. And he sets up the oil weapon. And on October the 16th, 11 days into the war, the Arab oil ministers gather together in Kuwait. And there's a new sense of confidence. The leaders of the Arab oil states are also buoyed by the knowledge that the industrial world was dependent on them, which previously there'd been much less of a hold on the oil industry. But by 1973, they have OPEC and they have the ability to use this as a weapon against the West.
This is the time where the Shah of Iran realizes, you know what, you've not been taking me that seriously either. Yeah. We've got OPEC, I got oil, and there is a lot of muscle flexing that causes absolute panic in the State Department in the United States, particularly when formerly tame powers or tame leaders are suddenly turning around saying, you know what, actually, no, we have our hand on the taps because we got all the oil and we can turn it off.
Two things that happen immediately. 4 days later, after this meeting in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia declares a total embargo on oil exports to the United States, a direct result of this airlift of tanks to Israel. And the Netherlands, who at that point is Israel's most vocal European supporter, is also added to the embargo list. And it's the first time in history that oil has been used as a deliberate political weapon against the Western powers. And the effect is immediate.
So all of this, like I said, you know, sort of leading to diplomatic quaking. And where there's a diplomatic quake, you often find Henry Kissinger, because it becomes his sort of sole duty to do this sort of shuttle diplomacy, flying between Jerusalem, Cairo, Damascus, dozens of times. I mean, the air miles on this man during this period, trying to get some kind of disengagement agreement, separating the armies, but also ensuring the taps are turned back on, that this does not impair American reach into oil. The embargo ends in March 1974, but the oil price never goes back. Pre-embargo, the price for a barrel of oil is $3. After embargo and after Kissinger diplomacy, it stays at 12.
Correct.
It just doesn't never will. That world of a $3 barrel of oil, it's gone. That's never going to happen again.
In Britain, America and the Netherlands, there's queues around the blocks, people trying to get petrol and petrol stations unable to get it. Speed limits reduced. Sunday driving is banned in several European countries. The British government introduces a three-day working week to conserve energy. American motorists queue for hours at filling stations. The Western economies, which had grown without a break since the Second World War, go into the deepest recession since the 1930s.
Yeah.
And a conflict in the Middle East has made ordinary people in towns like Birmingham and Pittsburgh feel the consequences in their daily lives in the way that nothing in the Middle East had previously done. And this completely, of course, changes the political calculus.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, do we not then see in this period of time that you get the Gulf super wealthy states? Because they've also realized, hello,
we've been undercharging for this. Yeah,
we can get more for this. And so you have this ballooning of income for Saudi Arabia, for example, from $4.3 billion in 1973 to $36 billion in just 3 years in 1976.
Extraordinary.
Abu Dhabi, Qatar, they all go through these transformations. You know, these huge skyscraper edifices that we see. This could only have happened after they realized the value of what they've got and that they can charge more. And, you know, wealth funds reshape culture and the political landscape and indeed the mindset, one might say, of the Arab world. You've got this huge money flow that's coming in. But it also coincides, and I need to understand more about why it also coincides with the spread of Wahhabi Islam as well, because we talked about this before, it's the 1970s, where you see a much more hardline, much more conservative Islam spreading, even as, you know, the petrodollars are flooding in.
So can you remember, we talked to Kim Gattas about this in her brilliant episodes on the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And we'll be coming back to Kim, actually, talking more about this. But she, brought up in Beirut, begins to see the spread of Wahhabi missionaries, these very puritanical, hardline Salafist and Wahhabi preachers. And, for example, in Pakistan, you suddenly find a King Faisal Mosque. An enormous mosque being built in Islamabad. Mosques, madrasas, Islamic media organizations right across Africa and Asia, spreading this very hardline form of Islam. And this is going to change the entire spirit of the Islamic world into the 80s and the 90s.
It feels so current.
It does.
Doesn't it?
This is obviously why we're doing this series now. Not only do we have the consequences of Imperial Israel, if you like, Israel no longer the frightened newbie in the region surrounded by hostile states, but having moved out beyond Gaza and the West Bank, and as we'll see, moving into Lebanon in the 1980s.
In 2026, right where we are now, the supply of oil is being used as a military instrument by Iran.
And again, you kind of feel that if only this American administration were listening to Empire Pod a bit more closely.
We wouldn't think that. We need to replace that question of how often do you think about the Roman Empire? How often do you think about the Empire podcast?
Exactly.
Because if people did a bit more, they might learn a thing or two. Yeah.
I don't know whether you've been watching Trump's interviews over the last fortnight, but he's been saying no one could have expected that the oil would have stopped. And that is obviously bollocks. Anyone with any knowledge of the region knows that the oil is the key.
What an academic turn of phrase you have, my friend. I mean, it's almost professorial in your gravitas.
I like to keep this gravitas for special moments.
I hope you're enjoying this series. I hope you're learning something from it. Next week, Avi Klein is going to be with us for this special bonus episode. And then we've got episode 6, Eugene Rogan taking us through Sadat's flight to Jerusalem and 13 extraordinary days at Camp David. So please don't miss it. And thank you very much for listening to us. We have now over 90 million downloads and we don't take any of them for granted. Anyway, till the next time we meet is goodbye from me, Anita Anand.
And goodbye from me, William Dirrenpool.